that, you know, she's so, but you know, I was thinking, I saw Pam come in and it's hard to sit there and believe you could be so together today. And then I want to tell you about Brenda or share with you about meeting Brenda. I truly believe in what our preamble says, that our primary purpose is to stay sober and, you know, be there for other alcoholics, you know. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety, plus our 12th tradition, you know, that we help others. And I've always tried to do that to the best of my ability. And, because, you know, I'm the one that gains out of that. You know, on the other end of that, I'm the one that gets the reward. And I've usually tried to go every time I've called to go. But I believe it was, what, October 12 years ago, right? Brenda, or as our sponsor, my sponsor, her sponsor, Mary Lyons, calls her Brender. We had several Brendas, and so one was Brenda, and she became Brender. And Brender appeared at our Monday night ladies' meeting, and I was stumped, because after the meeting, she was... When Brenda came in, she had her arm in a sling. She couldn't have stood up if she wanted to. I mean, she was just crouched over. You could tell, I mean, you could just, she wouldn't look in the face. She couldn't look in the face. Every part of her screamed that, you know, she was just in agony. And every time she even attempted to open her mouth, she cried every time. And after the meeting, she was out front, and a couple of the girls were talking with her, and I thought, well, you know, I'd been sober, you know, 7 or 8 years when she came in, and I thought, man, I think I ought to go over and extend my hand. And I couldn't do it. And I went home, and I called my sponsor later on, Mary Lyons. This is Mary. I said, I've never run into this before, but I couldn't even make myself go over to her. I said, I really did feel that if I did, she'd probably go kill herself. I was scared to death. And, you know, I gave her a wide berth for about 6 months. Because, like I said, and like I said, it had never happened to me before. And at about 6 months, another girl that she was living with, they were sharing a house. She may tell it, she may not. She was living in something called the greenhouse. And because, you know, I know some, none of y'all have ever come in here without a place to live, right? But anyway, she was living in this place called the greenhouse, and she called me. And this time of year, and I want to hurry up and get this over with and let you hear, but this time of year in the spring, I have asthma and my allergies, and I take to my bed a lot of times in the spring. And one evening, I had already taken to my bed, and she called me on the telephone. A girl that was living with her in this greenhouse had said, listen, I believe she had been to the doctor, and because she was so nervous like we are, I think he'd given her some pills. And this other girl said, well, I think you better call somebody who's been around a little longer and talk to them about this before you, you know, do anything with this. And she called me, and I was stumped again because I was too sick to even get out of my bed. But, you know, I just told her, I said, you know, I just don't think you want to do yourself in, you know. I said, you know, I think, you know, if you'll just not take all those pills and kill yourself tonight and go to a meeting tomorrow when you get up, everything will be good. And like I said, I was too sick to even go to a rescue. So the first couple of times I even tried to be of any help to Brenda, I couldn't help her at all. But I hope through the other years that I've made that up, Brenda. And you're in for a treat. She has recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. Thank you.
Hi, everybody. I'm Brenda. I'm Brenda Farr, and I am an alcoholic. I want to thank you all for inviting us over here. This is wonderful to get to come back. This is not the first time I've been here, and I've been invited to do it again, and that never was true for me in the past. Nobody wanted me back anywhere. I really appreciate Mary Shaw. I got to tell you, I got a little brother in recovery, and he calls Mary Shaw my lieutenant. And the first string is in Land O'Lakes, taking care of another one of her fellas that's been sober a little longer than me, picking up a chip tonight. And so the lieutenant brought me down here because we don't go anywhere alone anymore. I don't have to do anything alone today. I want to share just a moment where I'm at before I get into my story. See, willingness is not all-inclusive and forevermore and locked in. You get a little willingness and you exhibit it and act on it, and then you think you're willing, and then something else happens. For those of you who listen to Father Martin, the lieutenant uses the peanut butter story a lot because she doesn't have a lot of air. She has asthma and she can't talk a lot. So she just tells you not to touch the peanut butter. And I had an issue this week, and it was not going to be different. And I said, I'll just have to call and decline. And she walked me outside and she said, you need to call them and ask them if da 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 da. And I said, no, they don't do that. The department does not do it that way. And she said, you need to call them and say, and she said it about three times, and I thought, you know, to shut her up, I will call them. And I called them, and the bottom line is I am getting an interview on the telephone in the hospital directly after surgery, which is not done with the department I work for, because I just got willing enough to take a little direction. You know, when I got here and they talked about direction, my attitude about that was, why in the world would I let winos tell me what to do? You guys might know something about something, but now directing my life, a bunch of drunks, go figure. So it took me a while to accept the idea that direction was a good idea, and so they showed me the original manuscript. And today I believe that I need direction and I need people outside my life looking at it from another point of view. I started drinking when, you know, like everybody does, when I was a kid. I was raised out on the West Coast by a great aunt and uncle, and I had an older sister. My parents had not stayed together, and they'd left us there as babies, and this aunt and uncle were older, and she was very abusive. Not physically abusive to me, but to my sister. And I grew up in that, always being told and perceiving that the reason Barbara endured this physical abuse was because she didn't do this, did do that, wasn't good, was bad. I was a good little girl. And what that does is you grow up in a straitjacket and you believe that it will not happen to you if you're just always good. So I never got my hands dirty, never messed up my little organdy dresses, you know, did the right thing all the time, and wondered why she didn't. Wondered all my life why she, well, of course that's not what causes abuse, but I didn't know that till I was grown and in here with you guys. I just figured if she would have just done what she was told. So when I was about 13, I had the opportunity to go visit my father in another state. My dad was a practicing alcoholic, and he wasn't home all the time, and I could slide out the window and get out among them. And that had never been true in my life. I spent my whole life in the backyard or in the house. Now I'm getting out after dark and I'm meeting some other people. And I met some older people. They were like 16 or something. I met a young man and he gave me a drink. And that was, that was it. That was really, really nice. Everything got different real fast. And the drinking worked for me. And the reason I know that is because I married that young man a couple of years later. And that didn't last near as long as the drinking. The drinking I did not let go of. I went back to California, back and forth to my dad's and hither and yon. And as soon as I was 15, I left home and went to the military installation in South Carolina, and we got married. There was a war going on right then, and things were, a bit different and a bit looser and what have you, and he was getting ready to go to Guantanamo Bay. So we got married, and he went away and left me there on the bay. Now I'm all grown up, you know, 15, and I don't have a boss, and I mean, I don't even have him. I don't have anybody telling me what to do, and the drinking was real available. You know, you're in staff housing, and it's everywhere, and so I really enjoyed myself. I enjoyed just about as much as they could stand down there. And when he came back, I had started creating a lot of problems. And so he was in trouble because of my problems. And he couldn't quit his job in the Marine Corps. And so, you know, the alternative was either I go or the bottle goes. And I'll bet you know which one I did. So when I got back to California, I trooped down to Mexico and got a divorce. And on the way back, I stopped in San Diego and met whoever was next. You know, I was off and running. There was a war going on, and there was plenty of men and plenty of booze and plenty of activity. And, you know, the West Coast is eat up with military installations, and they're coming and going and flying and you know, floating and whatever all they do. And they all got those, you know, those cute little uniforms. And so I just got me one. And we went, you know, we went off drinking. And that was fine. That was fine. He was on a transport, and he would be gone, rather than go and stay in Vietnam, he would be gone 3 or 4 months, and then he would return for about a month. And that was really a perfect length of time. He could come in, we'd be on a honeymoon for a week, and then we'd be drunk for a week, and then we'd go to war for a week, and then the military would intercede and send him back out. And, you know, you can really run a relationship that way. You don't pay. You don't have to make any, you know, clean up anything. And so after a while, things geared down, and he came home and got shore duty. For anyone who doesn't know anything about the military, that means they're home every night. And they want things like dinner, and they want their socks washed, and you know, different things that were out of my realm of understanding. And I'll just say there wasn't any sock washing going on. And so so I just had to move on. And you know, I don't know about everybody else, but in my drinking, I always, like, I would have a job, but I'd be looking at the place across the street because I knew that they were going to fire me, or I was going out the back door. Or I'd have a man, and I was looking at the place across the street because I knew they were going to fire me or go out the back door. And that was the way my life was. So there was, you know, something going on over there, and I eased on to whoever was next. And whoever was next was different. As I changed geographically, I always added something, always found something a little bit new and special to add to my game plan. And this new and special was a Hell's Angel. And I had not seen anything quite like that before. And so, you know, I wanted to try that out. excuse me. And so, he took custody of me, and he taught me some new things. And for a period of time there, I didn't drink a great deal. I became heroin addicted and was incarcerated for it for 2 years. In those days, they called that treatment. Now, treatment in the 60s was not like it is today. You did not play volleyball until your insurance ran out. You were housed we were housed in the women's prison in Corona, and everything was exactly like the Department of Corrections, except an hour a day in the morning and an hour in the evening. You had group therapy. You sat around and told each other what you know, what was wrong with you. And other than that, you were in lockdown. And it was all the same. You know, the everything was the same. And so I didn't like that. I didn't like being afraid to go take a shower alone. I didn't like not having any autonomy. I didn't like being told what to do all the time. I didn't like being scared all the time. See, I was really a wuss, and had been taken care of all my life. However, badly. I handled that. I still had always been cared for and by something outside myself, and being amongst people who had lived in a violent way, I didn't know how to take care of myself at all, and I was terrified every minute that I was there. So what I learned there was that I didn't want to be there, and my deal of not going back there, my understanding of how to not do that, was to not do anything illegal. Drinking isn't illegal. In this country, you can drink yourself to death and they will not stop you. There is absolutely nothing illegal about going out right now, out that door, and getting all I want to drink. As long as I don't run over anybody or, you know, break any laws, steal the money to drink, it is legal for me to just drink myself till I die. And that's what I set out to do. I just was going to drink on and on and on. And so my dad, who was still practicing, daddy practiced on until the end of his life, but he wasn't the kind of alcoholic that I was. He, you know, he managed to like keep a family together and pay the mortgage and keep a job and, you know, not destroy all his cars and all his relationships. And it was different with him. He didn't do like I did. I just never could stay put anywhere. My dad came, he had moved to the West Coast. He came and got me out of there when it was time for me to be released. And he had three little kids and a nice wife, pretty close to my age, young lady. And they did everything they knew to do to help me. They took me into their home and they really, really offered me all that there was there. And they wanted me to do things, though, that I just couldn't do. They had some really tough rules, like Daddy said, I don't want to explain to your brother and sisters where you've been, so be home before daylight. Well, I thought that was pretty unreasonable. And, you know, most of the things that they wanted me to do just didn't wash. And meanwhile, Daddy worked at a dairy, and he had dragged home some old rag that whose wife had thrown him out or something. He's sleeping on our floor. And so, well, you got it. That was whoever was next. And so we slid on out of there. And, you know, then we could stay out all night or wherever we wanted. And he drank like I did. And that's what I really loved. He drank just like I did. Man could drink a barrel of beer a week. He, however, paid his child support, paid the mortgage, took care of me, went to work every day. When he was still too impaired to drive his truck, his supervisor would drive the truck and he'd do the work. He never missed a day's work. I don't think he has till now. He was a pretty good old boy till he got with me. And I don't have a real good effect on men. So anyway, I did all the damage to him that he would let me do, and now I'm driving drunk. I have stopped walking drunk, and I'm driving drunk. Excuse me, driving drunk. And I guess he got tired of fixing the cars, you know. And so he showed up one day and just told me he couldn't do it anymore, and he found whoever was next. And I didn't like that. I didn't like that at all. We had a little girl. And so my response to that was I scooped her up and took her to another state so he couldn't see her. I'll show him. But I could not keep it together. I couldn't keep a job. I couldn't keep sober enough to even get her to school. I couldn't look after her at all. By now my drinking had gotten so bad that I just was totally out of control. And I didn't know that. I knew I drank too much, but I didn't know it was the drinking. I heard my sponsor say that one time, and that was absolute fact. See, I knew that people shouldn't drink like I did, but I didn't know all that trouble was cause of the drinking. I thought I drank cause of all the trouble. And so anyway, I came back. We were in Atlanta then, and I went to him, and I told him that... I asked him if the young lady that he was living with would be willing to look after our daughter. And so they got married, and I took my daughter there. And it was probably not motivated by anything good, But my sponsor says if we do the right thing, even for the wrong reason, it comes out right. And it was the right thing. I absolutely in my heart know that it was the best thing in the world for her. She didn't have to live in an insane asylum anymore. So she stayed over there, and I was allowed to go and visit her whenever I was sober enough to get there, which was not near often enough. I went on, and I just really, really could drink like I wanted to. Now there wasn't anybody. There wasn't anything to even the semblance of accountability. And I was always in the restaurant business because, you know, you can drink when you work, and so it's a good place for restaurants. And I was always did that sort of work, and there's always plenty more of it. So you don't have to get along with the other people there. You don't have to behave yourself. You don't have to follow the rules because, you know, you can take this apron off, be out the back door and working across the street in another apron in 20 minutes. And that was how I lived. And it got to me that that I was real restless, irritable, and discontent. I don't think I put it quite that way, but that's what I was. And I thought it was because, you know, all them guys. Listen, they really will put you over the edge. And it was all those customers always, you know, barking orders at you and wanting you to do things. And them people that you worked with that always knew more than everybody else and always so willing to just tell you how much more they knew than you did, and you didn't do it right. And, you know, if everybody would have just left me alone, I wouldn't have had a drink like that. So I decided that I would change careers. Now, I skipped a little here. I had had 4 drunk driving arrests in California, which is why me and the old rag moved to Georgia. And then I got a different driver's license and a different name. And I had been arrested 3 times there for drunk driving. So my response to needing a career change was I went to truck driving school. And why are you laughing? You're laughing, Mary. So that's what I did. I got my credentials, and see, I had a lot of names, so I could get a new driver's license. When I needed another driver's license, I just pulled another name out of the hat. I always had some kind of document with, you know, that you could back it up with. That's one of the perks of all those guys. So I got my credentials and I got a job. I got a job with a lady who owned her own truck, and she was going to teach me how to live on the road and you know the deal, because it's a whole lot more than just shifting gears. There's a business to it, and there's some real things that a person needs to know if you're going to do this. And she was willing to teach me. She was a delight, beautiful young woman. And so we went off together, and I worked for her for a while, and we really had a nice relationship. She was just very, very gentle natured and caring, and responsible, you know, and accountable. And my drinking just really got worse and worse and worse. And she didn't drink. I mean, she drank. She's one of those people. You know them little bitty cans of what is that stuff? Malt liquor. They used to have them in little tiny cans. Well, she would sometimes, when we'd shut down the truck in the evening, she'd have one of those, part of one of those, and go to sleep. Not pass out now, just go to sleep from a hard day's work. And I didn't grasp that. But as soon as she'd go to sleep, I was out the door. And, you know, and I'd be really wasted. And it would come time to make the delivery. It would come time to do what we needed to do. And I couldn't get up, and I couldn't function, and I couldn't manage. And so she looked at me one day, and she said, you know, Brandy, I really love you, but you got to go. I got to live in the night. And, well, you know, I was real disturbed with that. I thought, she's just jealous of me. And so she wants rid of me because I am so special and I'm in her way here. And so I'll show her. I'll go get another job. So I made the rounds of the trucking companies, and I hit up on a safety director that was not real ethical. And he was going to give me a job. But he knew that I wasn't qualified to go to work for his company by myself. So he asked me, would I take a training driver? And I said, sure. I would have gone off with an orangutan. I wanted to go to work, so it didn't matter. It didn't make any difference to me. So he says, well, this person will be in Saturday. You come down to the road and meet him, and if he agrees to take you after he's met you, then we will hire you, and you can run a few months training with him. So I spray painted my blue jeans on and went down there with my spike boots and you know the deal, and trotted across the yard, and the safety director was standing outside talking next to a truck talking to this person. Now, he hadn't been described to me. I didn't have a clue what he looked like, but when I saw him over there, I saw him. I mean, it actually, what I saw was, you know, that aura that lifts off on the sickest man in the room, kind of draws it. But that's what I saw, and you got it. He was next. Now, he didn't know it right then. He was real slow. He didn't know he was whoever was next till later that day. But anyway, off we went. He explained to me what I was going to have to do to get in his truck. And I agreed to that, and we took off for California. At that time, we were in Birmingham, Alabama. I moved a lot. And so we left for California. We made a round back to New York and made some other stops along the way. We were gone 3 weeks, and when we got back, we got married. And we embarked, if you will, on a rough 15 years. Now, all these other guys had lasted maybe 5 or 6 years, and, they just didn't measure up. You had to be a bad boy to mess with me. And this individual was a bad boy. The big book talks about him. Laura Companion. I went out and found mine, and I married him. And absolutely, absolutely wrestled it to the ground. He was not just a truck driver. He was a career criminal. And because of that, see, he fit my needs, because they move a lot. They don't stay put a lot. And he had done, by the time he got to me, done everything that he could to everybody that he could. And he was just a real, real violent individual, none of which put me off. So we lived in this truck for several years and had a little boy. We were married a couple of years and had a little boy. And we kept him on the truck until time for the first grade. He never had a home. We dragged him up and down the road. And it was a very, very violent relationship. This had its good side, though. One of the reasons that I decided to marry him after this long courtship was because he didn't drink. He didn't drink at all. Couldn't stand anybody around him drinking. And I had, realized that I probably shouldn't drink so much, and maybe if I was exposed to a better class of person, I wouldn't. So it was a good criteria for marriage, and that's what we did. And every time that I could get out of his sight, I got drunk. Every time that he would leave me anywhere, we'd be down in a motel, or a few times we would have like a place to live here or there, and he'd leave me off the road for a little while, I would be drunk. I would be drunk and in jail. I would be drunk and wrecked a car. I would be drunk and done something. And he would come back and go ballistic, and it was the dance. It was the cycle. And what I know today is the reason I had to stay there 15 years is because I had finally found something that no matter what I did measured up to him, I still didn't look that bad. I could stand myself because he looked worse than me. So anyway, we stayed, my little boy and I, we stayed home one particular trip, and I got drunk. My son was in a daycare center. He's about, I don't know, a year and a half, something. And I went to go pick him up. And they were about to close, and I was rushing across town and hit a telephone pole. I had a vehicle that was a convertible. One, some old car. It was a long time ago. And when I hit the pole, I was making a left turn. I took out the whole passenger side of the car, leveled it, completely totaled it. Now, what I know now is that if my child had been in a car, it would have killed him. I mean, there wouldn't have been any way that he could have escaped in his little feet. My response to that was, why are they taking me to jail? Why are they interfering with me? My foot slipped off the brake. Something, you know, some kind of justification. And today I'm real grateful that I didn't get to that daycare center. They might have actually given me that child. I lost another driver's license. We went to another place. We got another driver's license. And things are getting real, real bad. He left me home again. And I was drinking at home now because I didn't have a vehicle. So I was home, and Larry should not have been coming in. He shouldn't have been home for about a week, so I could drink like I wanted to. Everything was quiet at my house. By now, I can't get along with anybody. Hard drinkers didn't want me around. Nobody wanted me around, so there was really nowhere to go. So I had my little boy in his room, and it was quiet and evening. It was dark, and I was in my bedroom, you know, already laying down, wasn't asleep, but I was drunk. And if you don't drink and you hit the door of a house where people are drinking, you know there's drinking going on in there. And he came in off the road, and he went ballistic. And of course, I always had such polish and such fine skill, I just leaped right up in his face, and that didn't work too well. And this was the most violent exchange that we had ever had. And when it was over, I was not conscious, and he left. And at some point, he came back. I don't know that maybe he was afraid someone had heard him screaming and he might get arrested. Anyway, he came back and he got me, and he took me to the hospital. The only reason I talk about this is not because I'm such a victim. Believe me, I'm not a victim. I stand up straight and all my limbs work correctly. I am not a victim. But the deal is, when he took me to the hospital, he told them there that I had gotten whipped that way in a bar fight. Well, he was a sober man talking sane and rational, and I was drunk and looked like we look, and they believed him. I was in the hospital for some time before anybody believed me. I always like to share that when I talk, because see, the deal is, even when we're right, we're wrong. We have no credibility when we drink. Our credibility is gone when we pick up the first drink. Even if we don't act out, it doesn't matter. Nothing anymore. It takes us seriously. Well, I got out of there finally, and he had left the state. And so they released me, and I wish that I could tell you that I stopped drinking, but I didn't. Went right back out. I had staples in me. I had somebody else's blood in my vein. I went right back out and got drunk again. And the next time, I had a vehicle now. The next time, I drove off a cliff, and we were in Arkansas. We were in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And the Arkansas River is, they float barges down it. There's a channel down in the middle of it. And it's extremely deep right from the bank. Well, I went off this cliff and down to the bank of this river. And by the grace of God, the car hung on something, a tree trunk, something down there. And I didn't go in the river, but it was rocking. I remember going, being airborne. I don't remember landing, but I remember coming to and looking out at that inky water because it was dark, and trying to get out. And this car had left its door locked, left its windows, and the doors had bashed in going down, so they wouldn't release, and I couldn't get out. And I was terrified that I was going to slide into that water and drown. I can't tell you how terrified I was. I'm really ashamed of that. I'm really ashamed that that's what it took to stop me from drinking. The option of killing my children, leaving my kids scattered all over the world, destroying the relationships of all the people that loved me. None of that stuff stopped me. I wish that I could say that some of that stopped me, but it didn't. But now I'm really, really scared. And so I said one of those prayers. Father Martin says those prayers we pray at the bottom of the jail, at the bottom of those cliffs, are the most sincere prayers we ever pray. Well, I prayed one, and I asked God to please spare my life, and I wouldn't drink anymore. And he did, and I didn't. And so the police came, got me out of there, and took me to the hospital, took me to jail, went the gamut of the deal. You know, I mean, there's a step system to drunk driving. There really is. It's like a whole set of steps you go through for drunk driving, and I did the steps, and I did not drink anymore. That was in 1985. I have not had a drink of alcohol since then. However, my sobriety date is October 3rd of 1990, and I say that because I came here dry and insane, dying from untreated alcoholism, and we do not talk about that enough. And when I got here, I didn't think y'all were going to let me stay. See, I didn't think I qualified because I wasn't drinking, so obviously that wasn't my problem. Well, drinking is not the problem of this alcoholic. Drinking was the solution for this alcoholic. And if an alcoholic like me doesn't have a drink or a program, she's a real sick piece of work. And what Mary Shaw just described is what had happened to me. I was 5 years that way, and I was insane. What do you say? They don't hook up? The signals, yeah. They misfire. All the little things in my brain were misfiring. I couldn't get anything together. That's probably a blessing, because it seems like if we come here and we're cognizant, after we're an hour and a half sober, we know more than the people that are trying to help us. Well, I knew I didn't know anything. What I didn't know was if y'all were going to let me stay. So I was afraid to talk back. I was afraid to say no. And, of course, some of y'all know Mary Lyons. It wouldn't matter if you said no to her anyway. But you know, she really doesn't care what you think, feel, or believe. Brenda, nobody asked you what you wanted. Just get in the car. So that's how it worked. They would take me places. They'd sit in the front, and they'd talk to each other. They'd talk about me like I wasn't even there. They acted like they didn't know I was crying. I didn't even know Mary knew that. I knew. But what I can tell you is that nothing has happened in my life. No crisis, no joy, no pleasure, no nothing has happened in my life that she hasn't been right there with me, walking down that road with me, taking me to the places that I couldn't go alone, telling me how to get through it. When I had to go by myself, when there was something that had to be done that I had to go alone, giving me minute-by-minute instructions on how to do it. Just do it this way. Just try. And, I don't know about everybody else, but I really needed that, because everything that I had ever done in my entire life did not work. I hear people talk about they crossed the line and became alcoholic or being restored to sanity. Well, see, I had never had any. So I didn't have anything to be restored to, and I did not cross any line. I picked up a drink, and I was an alcoholic, and my drinking was always sick and aberrant and non-functional and not socially acceptable. But my defects are not the activities that happen when I'm drunk. You know, people who are not alcoholics go out and show their butts when they get drunk. They fall off bar stools. They get problems with their motor skills. They get arrested for drunk driving. But the deal is, most of them, when they choose to not do it anymore, can follow through with that choice. Well, I never could. I never could. A drop of alcohol in me, and I'm off to the races, and I have no way of knowing when that's going to end, how it's going to be. I just know that I don't have a choice, then I am without a choice. And so I came, and I cuddled up. Now, I did not always like it. Do not misunderstand me. I did not think that this was a fun deal. And I recently have heard my sponsor say to me about my sponsee, she'd say, I don't think you're doing your job, because if you were, she'd be on the phone with me really bitching about you. Well, see, I didn't know I was allowed to do that. I thought that I had to pretend to think that everything that she said was just exactly perfect. Trust me, I did not think that. But they didn't care what I thought. They told me that what I was thinking wasn't what was getting me any better. What I was thinking before wasn't what got me sick. You know, what I was doing and not doing was what got me sick and crazy and drunk and in trouble. And what I'm doing and not doing today is what's getting me better. And it's one action at a time. It is willingness to take an action, whether I believe it will work or not. And what I believe don't matter. It really has absolutely nothing to do with anything. I am a real opposite kind of individual, and a normal people, I see it on TV all the time, those normal people, they go to self-help and they go to psychiatrists and they go to witch doctors, whoever they go to, and they're told, you just have to rework your thinking. If you get your thinking to change, you will be a better human being. Well, let me tell you something. My thinking follows my actions. It does not matter what I'm thinking. If I'm picking them up and putting them down in the right direction, I'll get to the right destination. But if I'm over here thinking about trying to get there, I never get there. And that's how my alcoholism works. Now, I don't know about everybody else, but I know that that's how it's been for me. I have had to have a lot of help. The steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are designed to accommodate my needs. They are designed to gently bear me through the places that I cannot walk. And they work through my life and through your life. They work from God through you all. I get to see them demonstrated in front of me every day as long as I hang out with you guys. And as I see them demonstrated and I see the difference, I don't have to wonder if it works. I can see it works. Standing here tonight looking at a room full of miracles, a room full of successes. I know I'm a success. I can stand upright and talk out loud. And, you know, Angela asked me, was I nervous or scared? Of course I am. But that's okay. My sponsor says if you're not nervous and scared before you get up to the podium, you don't have anything to say anyway. So that's okay that you know, that I'm scared to be here. What isn't okay is if I say no. I never, ever say no if I am not already committed. That seems to have worked pretty well. I always knew I was powerless over alcohol, but see, I thought I was powerless over alcohol only when it was in me. I knew my life was unmanageable. But I thought it was all those gods. I always knew about God. I always, you know, we were raised in religion. I mean, that deal was locked in. So always had that in my world, but I never had a relationship with God. I was not involved with God. I really thought that I'd done too much, too much wrong, too many folks, hurt too much. For God to have anything to do with me. And, you know, I just sort of wanted to be that little girl that stayed behind the door and kept her little organdy dress clean and not disturb God. I didn't want God to pay too much attention to me, because then he would know what a mess I was, and then I'd really be in trouble. So when I got to you guys and I was told that it is God of my understanding, and, well, I don't understand God. That's okay, Brenda. You don't have to understand God. You don't have to understand anything except that you need something outside yourself, because what you're doing isn't working. And so I could do that. I could do that. I am not religious today. But religion as pertains to me is something that provides order and structure. And I get that from you all. My God is strong and alive in my life, and that's a spiritual condition. I have a practice. I have a constant daily practice, and that's my connection. And And I do believe God will do for me what he has done for everybody else here. See, what I believe about the third step is that I had to believe that it was possible and be willing to step out and try to go toward where it was happening. Like when I first got here and I looked around and you all looked so clean and so together and so rational, and I couldn't speak with five-letter words, and I couldn't show up with my body parts inside my clothes, and I couldn't behave myself in a public place. I didn't know how. But I wanted to do all the things that you were doing. And that's what the third step is to me. It's wanting to, deciding to. The rest of the steps have taught me how to. And, you know, I had to write an inventory. Well, my first one was a mess. And I carried it around, and, you know, and I didn't want anybody to see it. I couldn't leave it at home because the burglars might get it and tell on me. So anyway, I'm hauling it around, and I don't want... That year, they fed me so much, Russ wanted to write me off his taxes. And I was over there in the kitchen with a plate in my hand, sitting on that kitchen stool. Do you guys still have that never-ending stool? And she was ironing. She always irons. And she started asking me questions and pulling it out of me. What I knew when I left there that night was that it was not that 15-year marriage to that individual that caused me to be a gypsy and caused me to quit all my jobs and caused me to run and caused me to do all the things that I had done. I had been doing that all my life. I had been a backdoor person from day one. I would have done it before I was 13, but I just couldn't get away. So I began in an increment to start taking a little responsibility for my actions, see that it was about me and what I'd been doing and not doing, not what everybody's been doing to me. That night, I stopped being a victim. That was what occurred for me. I did not come away with a lot of relief. A lot of people talk about stuff, you know, getting up off their knees after their fifth step and there's a great weight that leaves them. Well, that didn't happen for me. That didn't happen for me. My relief did not come to me until I started trying to live some in the ninth step. There was a lot of stuff I had done to my family, to the creditors, to the, you know, to anybody that would let me. I had done a lot of harm and just stepped on out of it. So I had to go back and start trying to clean up some of that stuff. And I had to do that a little bit at a time. Now, what I do today for a living is 180 out what anybody would think I would be allowed to do. And the first couple of years that I was involved with what I do, I'm in law enforcement. And the first couple of years I was there, some of my 30-year-old wreckage surfaced. And I was terrified. And I went to Mary and I told her, I said, you know, I love what I do better than anything I've ever done. And I did not lie to get my job. They're gonna do a oral review and I'm probably not gonna work anymore. And she told me, she said, you hold your head up high and you put on your uniform and you go down there and you sit in front of those people and you just tell the truth. You answer the questions they ask you. Because you only have that job because God wanted you there. And when God don't want you there anymore, it won't matter what that review board says. You will be gone. As long as they let you come, you go. Well, I'm still there. It's been a lot of years. I'm still there. I'm not there today because I'm off hurt, but I'm still employed. And, you know, and I got a key to the handcuffs I haul around, and that's a real perk for somebody like me. I don't know about you guys, but for an old gal like me, that's a big deal. Things have gotten very, very different in my life. My kids like me. I'm having major surgery Tuesday, and my daughter is leaving her family, her children, with other in-laws, and she's flying down here to spend a week with me, that little girl that I left, because I just couldn't take care of her. She can't wait to come down here and be with me. Now, this has been a process. It didn't happen overnight. These things do not change overnight. They change an increment at a time because I've been willing to leave what I was doing and come be among you, to take direction, to stay with women. And you know, I cannot emphasize this enough. When we're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I don't know, for me, even now, we need to spend more time gender-specific than anything else, because we get into trouble with our hormones. All of us got into trouble with our hormones somewhere along the... I beg your pardon? What did he say? Yeah, thank you so much. I think I'll just... Yeah, I'm fine, Jimmy, thank you. I just lost my train of thought. There they go again. I know now that what I'm drawn to is not because he's tall, dark, and handsome. It's because he's tall, dark, and thick. And you know, and if any of you, old, young, on crutches, anybody who happens to have the remotest attraction for me, go talk to your sponsor because there's something bad wrong with you. That's just the way it is for me. And that has been the way it was for me. And so I hang out with a lot of women, and I got a lot of men friends. But see, I'm able to show up and be respectable today, and because of that, I am respected anywhere I go. You know, I always wanted to drink like a lady. I always wanted to be able to sit down with a little wine glass and drink like a lady, and, you know, cross my legs and look so... And I always wanted to look like a lady, and I wanted to be able to act like a lady. And, you know, I'll stand here tonight before you and tell you 2 out of 3 is not bad. Okay.